Decam glances at Jor as if to say, "This is all your fault." Jor notices that Decam's hands are no longer shaking and that he is ignoring his empty glass. "Stipulate that the Venerian myth is true. That every few thousand years their world moves. I've actually seen a paper, suppressed now, of course, that suggests that Venus isn't tide-locked, but that it merely has a very slow and irregular period." "Which is nonsense," Rostov says. "Not the concept, the idea that the paper was suppressed." "Perhaps not in your circles," Decam says. "I don't care about that," Jor says, growing angrier. "Stipulating," Decam says, "we must then accept the idea that the sunset is not a world-wrecking catastrophe, but far less damaging after all," he says. "If it had the ability to rearrange the surface of the planet, to wipe out all life, why are the Venerians still here?" At that moment, everyone in 13-plus feels the tower shudder. Jor fears that it's another attack on the lens, but soon realizes that it's the rain. A sudden squall has blown in from the bright sea, so strong it rattles the windows of the bar. Conversation ceases. Even Petros pauses in his work, glancing, like Jor, toward the big window, where the view of Venusport from on high has vanished, replaced by sheets of water and roiling black clouds. Jor wants to leave. It isn't fear. He's not afraid that 13-plus will be damaged. It's just the situation, the storm, the crowd, the growing sense of a sour smell all around him, which he blames on Rostov. He hates speculations, preferring facts. His emotions are confused, too. And all this is likely due to last night's events, the lack of sleep, and the stress of the situation with Abdera and Decam. He thanks Rostov and abruptly heads for the door. He realizes that what's really driving him is a desire to be out of Decam's presence. In fact, for the first time in 15 years, he no longer wants to be a terrestrian on Venus at all. Decam catches him before he reaches the elevator. "Where are you going?" "My flat." "Retreating is so unlike you." It's usually Decam, veteran of 10,000 drunken evenings, who calls a halt to the festivities. Jor will sit there until staggering. "I'm tired."
"Actually, you're angry. Not quite the same."
"Rostov
is a bore. Which I told you, worse yet, he's a fairly stupid one.
At least he could know his science." "It doesn't seem that anyone actually knows the science."
"Of sunset, there is no science. That's the problem."
Jor feels dizzy and nauseous. "What do you think?"
"Haven't I made that clear? I'm quite open to the idea."
"Your open-mindedness doesn't extend to, I don't know, making emergency plans."
"Jor, there can't be any plans, only evacuation, and then only at gunpoint. The flight here was so monstrous for most of us that getting back into those ships," he points towards the spaceport where three squat, shell-shaped vehicles wait, "is like being pushed off the top of a tower, risking death only to escape certain death."
"So we can't do anything?" Decam grins.
"Oh, well, we can resume drinking."
For the first time in their friendship, drowning in this tidal wave of betrayal, smugness, and transigence, Jor wants to punch Decam. He grabs his shoulder, about to turn him, but Decam sees what's coming and raises an arm to block it. "Oh, you're being tiresome." "Then I've always been tiresome."
"No, you used to be interesting in a perfectly American manner, treating your forced exile here as some kind of fresh start."
Decam is pointing at him now, accusing him like a prosecutor.
"Given your background, that was not surprising, and part of the fun of knowing you has been watching to see if you might be correct."
"You've almost finished the lens, and that will surely expand the terrestrial presence."
"Or Well, it would have, except for the pesky Venerians and their superior knowledge of their own world, and their remarkable long-range planning, of which we suspect little, and truly know nothing.
You suspected, obviously. Only out of habit. Given my own family and its history, I would have had to be much stupider to fail to be suspicious of everything I see, or to expect that everyone is keeping secrets, or betraying a friend.
Ah, well, yes, I can understand why you might see it that way.
I realize it's too much to expect an apology, Jor says. But can't you even acknowledge your mistake? Dikem takes an unusual amount of time to respond. When he speaks, his voice is harsh.
What makes you think I had any choice in the matter? Or that any Terrestrian has any control over his destiny on Venus? That we can take any action that will have any effect?
He laughs bitterly.
We're just being swept along like weed on the bright sea, my friend. Not just me. You too.
He turns and staggers. Jor realizes that his former friend is drunker than he's ever seen him. Given the number of times they've shared brew and the amounts, this is shocking. Could he be telling the truth?
Oh, by the way, Dikem said, after you left, that idiot Russian confirmed it. The sun is not only visible now, it's lower in the sky.
And then he enters the elevator. Jor lets the doors close.
He doesn't want to go with him.
By the time Jor reaches the ground floor and prepares to leave, the storm has passed. The rain has returned to its expected state of hot drizzle. Emerging from the 13-plus tower and heading towards his residence, he feels unusually alone. And no wonder. There's no Terrestrian traffic at all. The immigrants from Earth are all tucked into their towers, and the Venerian presence is non-existent too, with shops largely gone, or certainly abandoned, streets empty, and, in fact, no longer streets, but merely tracked areas between larger, untracked ones. The lens tower looms even taller in the near distance. Jor is drawn to it, following the pathway towards it that takes him between the two residence towers. Then he hears his name.
Jordan.
Abdira steps forward. She's clearly been waiting some time. Even her waterproof Venerian garb couldn't stand up to that storm. She's soaked, her hair plastered to her skull, making her look definitively alien. Yet the voice is the same.
What do you want? He asks. To apologize?
No.
To explain, then. He can't keep the sarcasm from his voice.
Impossible.
Then why are you standing in the rain?
To honor what we had, she says.
I can't do that. He wants to recall their times together, but it's as if Dikem's shadow hides them.
One day you will.
And, as if this is all she wanted to say, she turns. Now Jor grabs for her.
Is that it? You stood in the rain to tell me nothing?
No. To see you one more time.
You're leaving.
It's sunset.
You could have warned me. And now she laughs.
I have warned you. All of us have warned you. Since the day Terrestrians arrived, we've been engaged in the reliquary, yet you continued to build.
Is that why you cheated with Dikem? He says, struggling to find a motive. Because I built the lens? She gives him the Venerian stare.
I wanted you to build your lens, she says. And you should go to it.
Then she leaves, turning abruptly and without breaking into a run, moving so quickly that Jor couldn't possibly catch her. She's headed for the landing, where skiffs still bob on the tide. Jor watches her. He feels as he did when N'Jeri told him she must return to Africa. Times 10. And yet, how foolish to think they had a future. Venerian and Terrestrian. This moment was inevitable, Only the details remain to be determined. He can't go back to his residence yet, so he'll grasp for the last moment of his relationship with Abdira. We'll take her advice and go to his lens. By the time he's reached the top, he's worked himself into a proper Lennox-style rage. First, he finds that the security team is not on duty. Called off by Tuttle, or simply having deserted their posts due to a storm. Jor would have returned to the towers to find them, but not before assuring himself that the lens is secure. And it is. Controls caged and ready. Giant dish strong and steady, glistening from its recent bath. Jor looks to the east, toward the bright sea. Dikem told the truth. Not only is the sun visible, it is notably lower in the sky. The shallow water of the Venusport Delta is receding too, carrying with it the last of the Venerian skiffs, Abdira's clan, and Abdira. As it goes, so does Jor's spirit. He's enough of an engineer to know what this means. Soon, there will be a wall of water. How tall? Really won't matter. Even though he's hundreds of feet high, the violence of the crashing wave is likely to destroy the lens tower and all of the terrestrian quarter of Venusport. The evening is clear. He can see the four towers, their windows lit. Do those fools know what's happening? Dikem was right. No one believed. No one prepared. They would only head for the three ships at the spaceport if their towers fell on them. Suddenly, Jor has an idea. He enters the control station and powers it up. The lens controls that are designed to focus transmission beams work just as well on the visible spectrum. And now, with the sun making its first appearance in the Venerian sky, Jor moves the lens. It takes precious minutes, but eventually he has it in the right position, taking the light from the new sun and focusing it on the four terrestrial towers. Then, he narrows the beam, increasing the light and, more to the point, the heat. He knows the materials used in the construction of the towers, how truly fragile they are. TA's famed cheapness, having the surface be waterproof, was sufficient. The tops of two residence towers ignite, meaning that Jor's residence in one will soon be ablaze, and so will Dikem's in the other. Then the third tower, the oldest one, Tuttle's TA headquarters. Finally, the fourth, site of 13+. Jor regrets that, but only for a moment. The air must be changing, because he believes he can hear not only sizzling and crackling as the top floors begin to burn, but alarms. He hopes for alarms. He knows there is a chance he's injuring or killing terrestrians, not motivating them to save themselves. At this moment, frankly, it doesn't really matter. The water continues to recede, exposing a muddy sea bottom identical to the muddy plains Jor has crossed so many times on Venus. He tries to see, but clouds are forming to the east. Soon they will boil high enough to cover the setting sun. He looks up at the lens, tweaks his aim, then looks to the towers. There's a swirling layer of fog rolling in, not from the sea, but from the west, obscuring Jor's view of the base of the towers. But shifting light and shadows there suggest that people are gathered, that they're in motion. And now the wind kicks up from the west quite strongly. A sudden gust rattles the platform so violently that Jor is knocked down. He rises to re-aim the lens, thinking of the disappointment on Earth at the loss of the terrestrian base, at the thousands or tens of thousands with high EQs who will not be shipped off-planet. He's wondering why he has no sympathy for their plight when he sees the beginnings of a giant wave forming in the bright sea and is struck by a piece of the lens structure as it comes apart in the wind. When he regains consciousness, he is in orbit, at equilateral, strapped to the floor of a cabin whose four bunks are already filled with the injured. He feels cold, as if pulled from the ocean, and possibly he was. His head hurts. He's hungry.
"Welcome back,"
Dikem says from the open hatch. He too is injured, both hands bandaged. In spite of their last encounters, Jor is happy to see his friend. Happy to see anyone, in fact. "Some of us made it," he says. "Most terrestrians did reach the spaceport ahead of the wave," Ikem says, "which was fortunately on higher ground than Venusport. Everyone jammed in and took off so close to the waves that we generated a considerable amount of steam. But the tricky part was reaching equilateral here. The station wasn't in position for rendezvous, so all the ships had to linger in orbit for 2 days until calculations could be made." And here he smiles his smug Dekem smile. "If they had one of my devices, they could have solved the problem in half an hour." "How was I rescued?" "I was nowhere near the ships." "We had to go back for you 3 days later. One ship was able to find dry land again and set down. Fortunately, the lens still stands. You were quite a mess, unconscious when you weren't delirious. But even Tuttle insisted that you had to be found. So the lens, minimal damage, frankly. With a bit of work, it would be ready for transmissions from Earth on schedule." Dekem smiles. "Of course, it is now located in the middle of an inland sea that will soon, Rostov predicts, become an ice field in the new night side of Venus." Jor thinks of Abdira, adrift in the fleet of skiffs. "What about the Venerians?" "They were able to ride out the wave, as apparently they've done many times in the past." Jor absorbs this news. "One more thing," Dekem says. "I regret not telling you before, but I wasn't sure until I'd had time to talk with Rostov again and to examine the past." "Your injuries must have been severe." He raises his bandaged hands. "It will be months before I can lift a glass again." "Abdira's fling with me was deliberate. She went after me because of Relo Quere." He can surely see the confusion on Jor's face. "The Venerians not only take apart their physical world before the sunset of time, they also dissolve their relationships. We've already seen the clans and fleets realigning. We shouldn't be surprised that it extends right down to boyfriend and girlfriend." Jor is in no mood to argue, though it is close to comforting. "She could have told me." "Yes," Dekem says. "But remember how long-lived the Venerians are, how sophisticated they are in their choices and actions. I think she wanted you in a dangerous frame of mind. Angry, driven, eager to prove yourself." "Why?" And here Dekem smiles with what might be genuine warmth, as if acknowledging a difficult truth. "So you would be tempted to be a hero."
Tobias S. Bacall. Tobias S. Bacall is a Caribbean-born science fiction author. His work has been translated into 16 different languages. He has published some 50 short stories in various magazines and anthologies and has been nominated for the Hugo, Nebula, Prometheus, and Campbell Awards. He is the author of the Xenowealth series, consisting of Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, Sly Mongoose, and The Apocalypse Ocean. His short fiction has been collected in Nascence and Tides from the New Worlds. His most recent novels are Arctic Rising and a sequel, Hurricane Fever. His most recent collection is Mitigated Futures. Much of his short work has recently been made available as Kindle editions. In the harrowing story that follows, he shows us that some atrocities seem to repeat themselves down through history, even on another world.
Pale Blue Memories by Tobias S. Bacall. Read for you by Prentice Oniemi. 1. I grabbed the arms of my acceleration chair as we spun, our silver bullet of a rocket ship vomiting debris and air into the cold night of Venus's stratosphere. Commander Heston James, Sr., flung himself from control panel to control panel, trying to regain control of our craft, but the Nazi missile had done its nasty work well. From a distance, the great pearly orb of Venus had been a comfort to us, our exciting destination, a place that beckoned adventure. We would land for our country and strike a great blow against the German Reich, proving that the war machine of the United States of America was more powerful. The great space race that grew out of the guttering stalemate of the Great War saw Nazi moon bases and stations matched by Allied forces in the final frontier. Now, the race was on to claim a planet. But the sneaky Nazi bastards, unable to beat us to the sister planet's surface, shot us out of the sky with a missile that had boosted behind us from Earth, hiding in our rocket ship's wake until right as we deorbited. "Charles!" Commander James shouted at me, looking back over his shoulder. "Do we have communications?" I'd been flipping switches and listening to static for the last 10 minutes of terror. The faint, steady, reassuring pip from Earth was nowhere to be found, and our tumbling meant it would never be found until we stabilized, or it could mean all our antennas were snapped clean off. "Charles!" I shook my head at him. "No, Commander, everything is offline." In radio silence, we continued to fall out of the sky. Commander James strained against the G-forces snapping at us to continue working his panels, fighting for control of his ship all the way down, a hero to the last breath. Out of one of the small portholes, I watched the expanse of white clouds beneath us spin past, again and again. All this was a punishment, I thought to myself, as the blood continued to rush up against the inside of my head and dizzy me. Like Daedalus, I'd flown too high and been burned. Now I was falling and falling. People from my kind of family didn't end up becoming astronauts. My kind of family had aunts and uncles who had to drink from the other fountains and couldn't order stuff from the front. My dad came from Jamaica, towing behind the rest of his family. They came looking for jobs and ended up working out in the Illinois countryside. White folk could tell Dad wasn't white, but they weren't sure what exactly he was, due to his kinky hair and skin that browned when he worked outside too long. Dad said that back home they called him High Yellow, which meant he was mixed race, but looked more white than black. Folk up north were more uneasy about the idea of mixed-race people. In some ways, that made it harder for Dad. He was a living, walking example of miscegenation, a child of a white father and a black mother. "If you were one or the other in America," he said, "everyone knew exactly how to treat you." But being stuck somewhere in the middle left him pulled in directions that I couldn't fathom. He married a white woman, an even greater sin. We wouldn't have been able to do that in the South, but in the North, as long as we kept to ourselves and didn't flaunt it, people pretended it didn't exist as long as my mother and father didn't go out together. And as for me, I took after my mother. I remember sitting in front of the window, looking at my reflection, trying to get my father's comb to stick in my hair like it did in his. But instead, it would just slide out of my straggly, fine strands and fall to the floor. My fair-skinned mother would find me crying in front of the mirror and ask me what was wrong. I never had the words to explain to her, and that would sometimes upset her more. When I was 5, my father sat me down. "I want to tell you where you came from," he told me, his face serious, his gray eyes piercing my fidgety 5-year-old soul. "Because it's only once you know where we are from that you can understand who you really are." I nodded, like I understood the wisdom he was dropping on me. Mostly I was excited to be let into this circle of trust he was drawing around us. Because these were things we had to keep close to us as if they were horrible secrets. And yet, in fact, it was just the truth about how we'd gotten where we were. Sometimes simple truth was radical. Your forefathers come from the Ivory Coast in far-off Africa, from across the seas, he told me. He taught me their names and the name of the tribe his forefathers had once belonged to. I once knew the dances and some of the words as they were passed on to me from my grandfather, he told me with sad eyes. But I have forgotten them. But I have not forgotten where I came from, and you can't either. Your skin is pale, son, and that will be to your advantage in this world. You might go on to do great things here, but you have to know who we are.
Will we go back?
I asked, excited. He looked at me for a long time. I don't know if there is a back to go back to, son. We live here. It is what we know. And what we need to know is how best to survive, and more importantly, thrive. Because a man should be able to live anywhere in the world and not suffer. Do you understand? This is our home because we are here. And we are with each other. I don't know if he believed it, but at 5, looking up at his broad shoulders, the lesson embedded itself deep in me and took root. 13 years later, I would be flying trainer aircraft and pushing myself to beat everyone around me. More kills, more daring stunts. I'd been training in languages while in school, but left to help fight the Great War and Hitler's minions. I'd heard about the squadron of Negro-only fighters in the sky, heard that bombers were asking for the Red Tails because of their record of flying close and protecting. The Red Tails were breaking records in their section of the sky. I was secretly doing it over here, and one day I'd reveal myself, and it would be known that I was as good as any other pilot. Only I was a ghost. A shadow person, a secret with my one drop of different blood. And now I, Charles Stewart, with my mixed blood, would die on the surface of Venus in a spectacular crash, and no one would ever know what I'd truly accomplished, would they? No one would know I'd been as good as any white astronaut, and they hadn't even known about me in their midst. I'd flown too high. No. That was the blood squeezing against my brain. I'd flown high. I was proud to have flown high. We plunged through the thick clouds of Venus, and for a brief second I saw lush green vegetation and wide expanses of ocean. Commander James cut himself free of his restraints, slamming into the bulkhead and cutting his head open.
"Keep calling out elevation, Davis!" he shouted back at the navigator, Tad Davis.
Tad began shouting out the numbers as we fell. Heston pulled Shepard Jefferson out of his chair and dragged him back on hands and knees, deeper into the heart of the craft. I could hear banging and swearing. Eric Smith, our geologist and general scientist, grabbed my arm from his position, strapped in on my left.
"I know communications is down, but patch me in anyway."
He stared out of the porthole.
"I'm going to broadcast what I can make out as we go down, for the benefit of whoever might hear something."
The ears of the world might be straining to hear us, and Eric was a scientist to the last. I linked his microphone to the radio.
"You're on, if we're able to transmit,"
I told him through gritted teeth.
"We're spinning wildly," Eric narrated. "But I'm sure I can see jungle out on the land we're far above. There are great oceans in between the main sections of land we're over, and there appear to be cloudbursts all around us. This is a rainy world. A wet world. A humid world. He continued on in that manner as the details grew, and Eric described mountains rising toward us, a lake, highlands thick with jungle. I had a wristband with a cyanide pill in it, in case things went bad. I idly wondered if it made sense to take it before we hit the ground. I didn't want to feel the moment of impact.
Ship, hold on,
Commander James shouted from back behind us. We slammed in our restraints as the craft suddenly decelerated. For a moment, I was cheered. We'd gotten the rocket back on and would descend on our tail in fire and triumph to the surface of this new world. But that wasn't it. We still yawed and swung. The descent was slow, but the thundering roar of the rocket was absent.
Parachutes, Tad said. They got the emergency parachutes open.
A wall of green flung itself at the portholes. My chair broke loose from its bolts, and I spun across the cabin in a sudden cartwheel as the rocket ship struck trees and marsh in a grinding screech. 2. The air outside was thick with moisture and the smells of exotic alien plants. Dark purple fronds filled the steep hills all around us, and just a few miles ahead, stony mountains jutted up into the air. We'd been just split seconds away from dashing ourselves against them, I realized. All five of us gathered outside to walk the hull at Commander James' insistence.
We need to know how bad the damage is, he said.
I just wanted to stand outside. We'd been cooped in a metal tube for almost an entire month, eating pills and squeezing food out of tubes. I wanted to just stand in the open copse created when the rocket ship slammed through the palm-like fronds. But we all nodded and followed orders.
How bad is it, Shep?
Heston asked, once we'd all walked a circuit around the silvered ship. We'd all pause near the water tanks that had saved our lives. Had the Nazi missile struck anywhere else, we likely would have died right then and there.
We didn't just lose water, Shepard reported. We vented fuel, and the hull probably won't survive taking us back up into orbit. The stress of firing the engine might well just cause the whole thing to crumple.
Heston looked thoughtful, thinking about all the variables, working on a plan of action. He looked out over the vegetation around us with a grimace.
Then, we're not here to explore and return. The mission parameters have just changed. We're here to survive until we can be rescued by another mission. Stuart, where are we with comms?
I looked up from staring at massive yellow lily pad-like leaves on a nearby plant.
I sent out distress signals the moment we knew the missile was there, sir, and all the way down, but the equipment's broken. I can look at the spare parts, see what I can cobble up, but I can't do anything until Shepard gets the power back on.
Heston turned back to Shepard.
Shep, I'll get to work on it. A couple hours?
Shep wiped his hands, then jumped back up to the doors and hauled himself into our broken ship.
In the meantime, Heston said, I need you and Eric to take some bottles and hunt for a clean source of water. Eric, get what you need to test the water. Make sure it's safe.
Yes, sir, we said, and I moved to help Eric get a couple of machetes and some large containers. We landed in the high foothills near a natural plateau. The ground was muddy, and at first the closest thing we found to water was several pools of swampy muck as we chopped through the jungle. Eric was quiet, no doubt as a result of being a bit shook up. But I was also out of sorts myself. I was happy to be by his side, though. A bookish type, Eric was the crew member I'd always liked the most. Of all the crew, he had yet to make a random comment about Italians, Jews, Poles, Blacks, or Hispanics that left me secretly angry but outwardly carefully neutral. I could relax a little near him, not expecting some sudden verbal explosion that would wing me. The heat and humidity caused me to sweat heavily as we hacked our way onward, and I pulled my long-sleeved shirt off to wrap it around my waist.
"I'd keep that on," he said.
"Why's that?" Eric pointed the machete at fist-sized black marks on the feathered leaves of nearby fronds.
"They're not exactly like mosquitoes, but they're giant bugs. Probably because of the denser air, I imagine."
I pulled my shirt back on. "Will a shirt stop a super mosquito?" I asked. He shrugged. "Don't know, but maybe it'll help." There were large gnats, clouds of which burst out from the ground like jittery dark thunderclouds when we disturbed them. Eric perked up after a while and began examining the vegetation, trying to pin down what it might be analogous to back on Earth.
"Very Mesozoic," he kept saying.
And all I knew about that was that it had something to do with dinosaurs. We stopped at the edge of two fetid pools of water while Eric examined them.
"Stagnant,"
he pronounced, and we kept on. The ground grew muddier, but Eric found a ridge of rock to scramble on that poked over the worst of it, and we began to skirt over the jungle. Occasionally, he stopped to draw landmarks on a pad of paper.
"There's no sun or stars or compass we can use here," he said. "We have to be careful not to get lost."
He also stopped twice to make quick sketches of brightly colored, long-tailed, bird-like creatures that burst out of the treetops and glided through the air. Eventually, we took a break near another flat plain by more swamp. By now, Eric was grinning, our predicament taking a back seat to his scientific wonderment at the flora and fauna of an alien world.
"There are tracks here. There seem to be large animals, and we should be able to follow them to a source of water," he said.
I sat with my back to him, looking toward the tall rocks we'd scaled down from, and took a long sip of water from my canteen. And it was then that I felt Eric's back stiffen straight.
"Charles," he hissed.
"Yes?"
"Don't make a move."
The ground thudded, and again. I looked oh so slowly over my shoulder. A 10-foot-tall, six-legged beast with dappled green hide and a fiercely reptilian face hissed at us. But that wasn't what made my stomach clench. A thin-limbed man, with skin so pale it looked almost transparent, stood up on leather stirrups and pointed what was unmistakably a long-barreled weapon at us. From farther down the trail, three more mounted Venusians plodded along, their long rifles aimed right at us.
"They're bipedal," Eric breathed. "And humanoid. How graceful."
"They have weapons," I murmured.
"This must be some form of parallel evolution. This is the sister planet, and these are sister peoples,"
Eric said to me out of the corner of his mouth.
"Or maybe we all come from the same organisms."
He didn't get to finish his thinking because the four Venusians charged us. The heavy-footed beasts thundered as their long necks slinked forward with more eager hisses. I grabbed Eric's shoulder and hauled him to his feet, and we ran. But within seconds, the thud of saurian beasts filled our world, and nets with heavy weights slapped into our backs. We fell to the ground, entangled and struggling to get our machetes out to chop at the netting. I managed first, sawing through and scrambling up. Eric followed. He raised his machete, and a bright flash of light cracked out from one of the rifles. Eric screamed and dropped his blade, then raised his hands warily.
"You'd better drop yours too," he said.
I let it fall to the ground. The Venusians regarded us with large eyes and dark pupils, then dropped to the ground with loops of rope. Within a minute, we were tied behind the beasts and being pulled along down the trail through the jungle.
"I don't understand," Eric said in shock. "We are visitors from another world. They must have seen the rocket ship. We must look alien to them."
This is a first contact situation. What are they doing? I don't know, I said, and gasped as the rope yanked at me. They pulled us into what looked like a village, with huts made out of long poles and woven with fronds. Weary Venusians sat around cooking pots. They began to shout and point at us with large smiles, while the Venusians who captured us responded with similar whoops. We come in peace, Eric declared, but was rewarded with a strike to the head for his efforts. I grabbed him as he staggered and helped him stand as we were shoved into a set of cages at the center of the village. I should have spent the next couple of hours paying attention and learning what I could about the Venusians, but instead I did my best to make Eric comfortable and keep him from falling asleep. A blow to the head was never a good thing. As a result, I almost didn't notice another party of Venusians returning in triumph with the rest of our crew. Commander Heston James, shoved forward by gunpoint, Shepard by his side, both of them holding Tad up by an arm and looking exhausted, bruised, and shocked. Inside the cage with us, Heston took a look at Eric briefly. He should be okay, he said in a grim voice. But Tad's in worse shape. He fought back, all the way. They shot him. There was a burned hole in Tad's stomach. It was blackened with cauterization, but we all had enough medical training for the trip to know that it was fatal. Charles, you're the languages and communications expert. Any read on these Venusians? Heston asked. I shook my head. I was the languages guy, which meant that I'd studied 7 or so before the war, while I was in college. The half-completed linguistics degree had helped edge me into the communications spot on the crew. It's another planet, another species, and I've been watching after Eric. Fucking savages, Heston spit. Animal riding, hut-living savages. I said nothing. Tad died a few hours later, gurgling out his last breath with a whimper of pain. Eventually, we all tried to get some sleep as the ambient, cloud-filtered sunlight faded away. We woke early the next morning to Shepard shouting at several tiny Venusians who were poking him with a sharp stick. Eric was looking around, dazed and awake, thank goodness. His only comment on the situation was a bemused observation. I think the super pale skin they have is an adaptation, he murmured. Almost to himself. Not much sunlight gets to the surface of Venus. If you look at people on Earth, it's the same. The farther north, the less sun, the paler they get. 3. We were taken down off the plateau the next morning on a 2-day-long, jolting cart ride to a fortress that looked like a giant sea urchin with black, spiked rock spurs radiating in all directions. Under one of the spurs, the Venusians argued for 15 minutes with another set of Venusians wearing fancy red silks. Then more Venusians came out with a crate full of rifles. I think we just got traded for rifles, Shepard said. Jesus Christ. The hill Venusians turned and left us standing in front of the spiked fortress, heading back to their swampy home. They won't know we came from the sky, Eric said, his voice quavering slightly. Then we learn the local lingo, Commander James said quietly, however long it takes us. And we tell them. They can see with their own eyes that we look different. For all they know, I said, speaking for the first time that morning, we're strange Venusians from some unknown location on their planet. Stow that talk, Heston ordered. The next week of travel blurred. More carts, baggage trains. Often we were forced to walk along them, our hands bound, pale Venusians shouting at us. Shepard and Eric had been keeping shifts, tracking our turns and directions, trying to keep an internal map of how to get back to our ship. The humid air stopped feeling so strange in the second week of walking. The feathery fronds of the vegetation began to stop looking so strange. Though every time something rustled from deep inside the vegetation, I still felt nervous. We arrived at a coast in the second week. A great walled city sat half in the emerald forest and half projected out into the gray ocean. Docks stuck out like fingers from a hand, and a crude seawall protected it all from the ocean swells. Rock houses leaned this way and that inside the walls. Warehouses painted in pastel shades leaked strange scents none of us could recognize. Was that cinnamon? With a bacony sort of vanilla? We'd been fed Venusian food, a tasteless, pasty stew that caused me to spend the first night in agony with stomach cramps, but that I'd adapted to in the days of walking. But smelling the scents, I realized we'd been given their equivalent of gruel. We followed our captors down streets no more than 4 or 5 people wide, then into a central market. It was filled with Venusians selling flanks of meat, what looked like misshapen vegetables in unappealing colors, and the spices that we'd smelled passing the warehouses. A short Venusian with scars advanced on us with a knife. We recoiled, but he used it quickly to cut our clothes away. "Damn it!" Heston screamed, uselessly, as he stood in the air naked as the day he was born, his naturally ramrod straight back suddenly curved as he tried to cover himself. Venusians threw buckets of water on us to clean the road dirt away and scrubbed us clean. And we were marched over to a stone dais. My stomach clenched as I stood there and watched Venusians cluster around to stare at us. "We're visitors," Shepard shouted at them. "Visitors from another world. Don't you understand? You should be giving us a parade." "Shep," Eric said quietly and looked at me. "I think Charles is right. They've never seen outside the clouds. They might not know about other planets, stars. They probably think we're just strange-looking Venusians."
"But we came in a rocket ship," Shepard protested.
"Is that anything like an airship?" Eric asked, and pointed over our heads. We looked up. A massive, lighter-than-air machine glided in over the ocean toward the city, slowly beginning to drop out of the air toward a large field. "The Venusians that captured us might not even know much about such things," Eric said. "They didn't know how to make guns and live in the hills. They sold us for the guns. They might not have even explained to these guys how we showed up."
He was right, and I was right. And I knew how right I was when it began. It might have been in an alien tongue, but I knew the patter for what it was. An auction. I began to weep silently to myself, suddenly alone and cold in the humid tropical air of Venus, rescue millions of miles away. Heston snapped at me.
"Get a hold of yourself, Charles. We're gonna figure a way out of this."
"Really?" I stared at him.
"It took hundreds of years back home for people to figure a way out. And even then, they still live as second-class citizens. Even if we do communicate with them, judging by all this, we may end up being little more than scientific curiosities."
The crew stared at me like I'd grown a second head. But we didn't have much time to debate further. We were ripped apart, the auction done. Heston and I were taken to a mansion with a vast cobblestone courtyard on the edge of the city's walls. Men in silks and headdresses covered with snake-like patterns of gold led the way, while short, scruffy Venusians poked and prodded us along. Then they swarmed us, grabbing us by legs and arms and holding us down to the wet stones as we struggled and fought the sudden immobilization. One of the silk-wearing Venusians kneeled next to us. He held a tiny slug in the grip of some tongs.
"What are you doing?" Heston shouted. I demand...
The Venusian shoved the slug into Heston's nose. For a moment, both slug and man lay still, somewhat stunned. Then it began wriggling, all the way up into his nose. Heston screamed. The Venusian was handed another set of tongs and turned for me, and I screamed and struggled to no avail. It slithered into my nose, a slimy wetness moving upward. Mucus dripped down my lip, and my nasal cavity screamed as it was filled with a pushing, tearing sensation. I tasted blood as it dripped down the back of my throat, and I gagged. The Venusians closed great stone doors at the entrance. Some bored guards with rifles patrolled an elevated walkway and looked down at us. But we were left alone on the courtyard stones to stare up at the clouds as our foreheads ached. Dark, gray clouds. Always. I'd never see a blue sky again, I realized, before I slipped into fever dreams. We vomited bile, bled through our noses, and curled into balls on the stones. Occasionally, Venusians would come and yell at us, "Get up! Do you understand us yet?" It wasn't until later in the day that I realized something. "Heston! Heston! I think I understand them." Heston groaned. "I thought it was you yelling insults at me. But I don't think you'd call me a kaftig, whatever that is." I could imagine Eric's telling us that our nasal cavities were the closest entrance in the body to our brains, and this slug would have crawled up there to... I staggered up. "I can stand," I said. "Can you understand me?" "Get up," a Venusian demanded. "If you can understand me, get up." Heston held on to my shoulder. He was excited. "We're visitors. We're from another world." He pointed up at the dark gray clouds that stretched from horizon to horizon. "We're from beyond the clouds." The Venusians around us laughed, a yipping, barking sound.
"There is nowhere else but the surface. And there is nothing beyond the clouds but more clouds and emptiness."
Heston wouldn't let it go. He kept arguing, and eventually his shouts led to warnings. Then the Venusians clubbed him until he shut up. They forced me to carry him, dazed, across the courtyard and into a small, cramped common house. It was dark and damp, and the floor covered in straw. We huddled in the corner away from other Venusians who growled at us as the door was locked shut for the night. The next morning, we were all led out to the landing fields of the city, where the airship slowly eased in over the ocean and came to a rest. Under the eye of two armed Venusians, we unloaded the airship's wares, packages of foods, jars filled with oils and spices. The sort of cargo that empires sent to far-flung cities at the periphery.
"I don't understand," Heston said. "They have technology. We're unloading airships. They have laser rifles. Why forced labor? This makes no sense. Maybe they don't have capitalism or democracy here. Maybe we'll have to bring it to them. Because I tell you what, a few good red-blooded American longshoremen would get this ship unloaded faster than any of these other poor creatures."
I must have snorted because Heston stared at me. "Capitalism and democracy included slavery until late last century, Commander. That was the American way until the Civil War. As far as I can tell, visiting the cotton fields, it is still the natural friend of slavery. You have family in West Virginia digging coal, right? Any of them in debt for life to the company store, being charged company rent for their home and company credit for their groceries? If you can force someone to work for free, isn't that the most profit ever? If all that matters to you is profit, then it's a natural endpoint. Heston stopped working and glared at me. Are you a communist? I had a retort, but one of the overseers waded in with a club. Heston stood up and shouted back at him, but earned several smacks to the head. By now, I was surprised he could even think.
Work,
we were ordered.
This is not the time for talking. Keep talking, and we'll sear your skin off.
We got back to lugging stuff off the ship to the waiting carts with their six-legged beasts patiently holding steady in their harnesses.
If we can just talk to the right people,
Heston whispered as we walked back.
We need to find a politician or a scientist. We need to talk to their leaders, not workers and overseers. Talk to just the right person in power. It will be okay.
The commander believed that. He believed that because, for him, it had always been true. His life had ups and downs, but for true injustices, he'd always been able to find the right person and set things right. There was order and justice. He truly believed in those things. The world worked a certain way for him.
If we get this over and see if we can petition a judge or someone, we might be able to talk to the right people.
Heston worked faster and faster, his mind set on the goal of getting the airship unloaded. I struggled to keep up with his newfound energy. The commander had a destination in mind, and now he had set himself to it.
Commander, I whispered, slow down.
He blinked.
Why?
The other Venusians aren't working as fast. Think about it. They're slaves. There's no reason to kill themselves working harder. They're not getting paid. The only way for them to make this bearable is to work just fast enough to not be abused, see?
Their laziness isn't my problem, Heston growled.
That night, the entire common house of Venusians beat us with balled fists. Heston gave as good as he could for the first 10 minutes, but there were just too many of them. The next day we could barely keep up. Our bruises and torn muscles were in so much agony, we gasped as we worked and said nothing to one another.
Welcome,
one of the other Venusians had said after he broke my ring finger beneath his blue-veined heel.
To the city of Kish.
4. Commander James got his chance to talk to the right Venusian after a long, back-breaking week of labor. Before the sun faded away, the Venusians would let us relax in the purple grasses inside the walls. I had settled near a reflecting pool, dipping my aching feet in it, when a retinue of colorfully dressed Venusians swept through the courtyard. In the center was the lord of the house, who we had come to learn from overheard chatter was a customs official for the city of Kish. Heston threw himself into the Venusian's path.
"My lord of the estate!"
he shouted as Venusians turned in shock and horror. One of the overseers, loitering around the edge of the courtyard, raised a rifle, but the lord raised his hand to stop the killing shot. I realized that Heston had faltered, as he didn't know the lord's name. He was only referred to as the lord. A pronoun, the pronoun. The only one that mattered within these walls. Heston stumbled forward.
My lord, I am a rocket man from above the clouds.
That was as far as he got. The lord shook his head impatiently and gestured, and Commander James was hauled away. He might have been stronger than the slender Venusians, but there were more of them.
Was he one of the new exotics?
The lord asked, and looked over at where I still sat.
Yes, my lord,
one of the overseers said, rushing to bow.
They work hard. Good. Worth the metal price. But do cut off their tongues if they ever dare babble at me again.
And in a flourish of silks and nutmeg-like perfume, the retinue left for the sound of music and laughter somewhere deep in Kish.
He is lucky they didn't take his tongue out as a first punishment,
said a Venusian nearby. She sported knife scars up and down her arms, and I could tell she came from the northern hills by her cadence and the punctures in the webs of her hands where she'd once worn gold rings. He's stubborn, I told her. I bet he will lose it before we are done here. I tended to a dazed Heston after his beating, trying to get him to drink water. I was trying to get him oriented because he was floundering. You know, free economies are rare, Commander, even on Earth. It's not surprising, really. If aliens were to land on Earth and look vaguely like us, it might not have been good for them either, being different. Imagine if aliens had landed in the South before the Civil War that we had to fight so bloodily to get rid of this stain. Through bruised lips and swollen eyes, Commander James said firmly, "The war of northern aggression was fought over states' rights." And with a grunt of pain, he picked up his blanket, his dog tags that he'd been allowed to keep, and dragged himself over to the other side of the common house. I became an alien on another world, with the only other person I knew refusing to speak to me. I was annoyed at first, working out arguments in my head that I would have with the commander when we next spoke. But the work ate into me. The moment the sun leaked through the clouds, Venusians beat us awake to head out to the fields where the large, silvered airships came to rest. And all day long we'd unload what the city of Kish needed to consume, and a lot of what its lords desired to spend their vast wealth on. "Where do these goods come from?" I asked the Venusian with the scarred arms. The first time I asked, she ignored me. But as we stood and waited for another airship to arrive and drank from water skins, she spoke to me.
"Other cities? Larger cities?" she said, pointing off toward the ocean. "The lords of Kish cannot do without the spices and foods from their mother cities, and Kish is not big enough to grow its own."
"And Kish trades rifles and machines for minerals, ores, and work," I said.
"Yes."
The next airship we loaded with scared Venusian hill tribe folk, possibly even some of the same ones who'd first captured us, now captured by some other group with laser rifles. We shoved and beat them aboard and tried not to meet their pleading eyes. One late night, she came to my blanket.
"My name is Maat of Tanish," she told me.
"I'm Charles Stewart," I said.
"Where is Stewart?"
she asked. "Nowhere. It doesn't matter. I'm Charles of Earth, and Earth is beyond the clouds."
"There is nothing but void beyond the clouds,"
Maya told me with a pitying chuckle.
"All that is important lies beneath the veil. There must be a reason we can't see beyond it, and that is most likely because there is nothing worth seeing."
I opened my mouth to argue with this, then realized that Maya was my only companion, and I was too tired to argue. I thought the weeks of training to be a spaceman intense. I had no idea. I'd had energy and verve my first few days.
But as weeks became months, my back felt like it'd been set on fire by the constant bending. My fire to understand and study the world around me dampened every day. There were no weekends, no labor laws to limit being rushed out in the middle of the night to grab the ropes of an incoming airship, then unload it once it was tethered. No time to recoup, just a slow, steady erosion. Might just lay next to me, and that was enough that first night, to feel someone breathing next to me. I struggled to glean information about where Kish lay from her and what was out beyond its borders. The free lands of wild peoples, hill tribes, what trails led where. I wanted to make a map of the world in my head before I made any decisions. I needed to find out how best to make my way in this world, and to understand its rules, no matter how horrific. And I'd always had to play the game of their rules and my hidden face. I remembered my grandfather telling me once, "Never show anyone what you're really thinking, because then they might know what you're going to do." Even Maet, as we continued to huddle in our corner of the common house, didn't know what I thought about. As Maet and I grew together, I saw Heston had started to talk to other Venusians. In the courtyard behind a tree, near the corner of the common house. I wasn't surprised when he crawled over to my blanket as I lay sweating in the tropical heat and humidity while Maet was off talking to someone else.
"Soldier, we may have our differences," he hissed to me. "But now, it's going to be time to fight together."
"You're planning a revolt," I said, looking over at his crouched form. It was a shadow against a shadow in the city light that came in through the barred windows at the top of the walls. I couldn't see surprise on his silhouetted face, but I could hear it in his voice.
"Yes. There are others who want their freedom. I've been talking to him. Will you join us?"
Ever since I saw him whispering to others, I'd thought about it, and about what I would say.
"You ever read much about slave history?" I asked.
"Probably not. It's not a field many people study. But let me tell you something. All of the slave revolts, except the one on Haiti, were put down. And we're not on an island that we could defend. Even in South America, where they had great numbers, they still remained under colonial rule for many long ages.
None of them had a U.S. Marine in charge," Heston hissed.
"You think none of them had any war experience?" I asked calmly. He didn't know their names or positions, because they'd been wiped out. But many early slaves had been captured in war. My own family held at least two tribal leaders, according to legend. One of them had committed suicide after 3 years of being forced to work a sugar plantation.
"They need the right kind of leader," Heston said.
I put a hand out to him.
"I wish you luck."
Heston hissed, no doubt disgusted with me and thinking me a coward. He ignored my hand and left as he saw Maet's silhouette coming toward us. Was I a coward? I could hardly sleep that night, bile in the back of my mouth. In the early gray light of dawn, I woke to Heston's screams. I remember the sound of a cat that had been caught by a hunting dog one of my neighbors had penned up when I was a kid. And it was something like that. A high-pitched mewling that didn't stop. It snapped me out of my dreams about blue skies and no clouds. Heston was in the courtyard, his hands and feet bound to a pole set into a notched hole in one of the flagstones. Venusians didn't use whips. They hung pink and snow-feathered leeches from Heston's chest and back. As I got close, I could hear a loud sucking crunch, and Heston screamed again. When the creature was finished, one of the overseers pulled it away, leaving a deep and ragged hole that streamed blood and black ichor. It smelled of licorice and rot. Venusian streamed past, darting sidelong glances as I moved to stand in front of Heston. He looked up at me through a haze of pain. "Charles!" "Who betrayed you?" I asked sadly. Heston coughed. "Thought it was you at first, but it was a Venusian. Telket. From one of the southern marshes. He stood here and announced to everyone what I'd done. Why would someone do that?" "The same reason it's always been done," I said, fiddling with my bracelet. "Even if your uprising had succeeded, most of our fellow workers in the common house stood a chance of dying from the repercussions. A slaver society reacts strongly to uprisings. They'd know that. By ratting you out, he's guaranteed a small improvement in his life. Most people go for the bird in the hand." Heston began to cry. "They're going to drag this out. They're going to kill me." "Or not," I said. "A living, crippled, and broken slave is a good example to have as well." "Oh, God." That last was a faint whimper. I thought for a long second, then continued. "You probably suspected this, given the things I've said. But some of my ancestors were slaves. My great-grandfather, he fought, like you, was whipped, hobbled, scarred by brands. But one day, after fighting so long, he up and cut his own throat rather than continue living under the whip. Not something I figured you'd appreciate before this morning, but something I've been thinking on ever since we were captured." Heston looked up at me with lost eyes. I cracked my wristband and removed the cyanide pill inside. "I know you didn't have time to use yours," I said. "Maybe they won't kill you. Maybe they'll keep hurting you. I don't know. But I want to give you this, just in case." I placed the pill on his tongue, like a priest giving someone a communion wafer. "Thank you," he hissed. One of the overseers struck me, yelling at me to move on. I left as they were putting the leeches back on. This time they ate at his ankles, and Heston sagged at the pole as his feet failed. My son said he was dead, mouth foaming from the cyanide pill.